All right, thank you so much. So I was very glad to take this opportunity to come. So to give honor to Agnes for her appointment here with Kiel University. And I've never been to Kiel. So that's a fantastic combination to combine these two things. So warm welcome from my side. I'm very happy to talk you through some perspectives on the technologies that you might have already seen in the previous parts of this lecture. And I want to lift the perspective a little bit further up, let's say to the to a more abstract level, because we are facing these challenges that we have various new technologies emerging every year, every month, you could even say every week, and the challenge is that we need to understand which of these technologies are interesting for us as a company. And in order to do this assessment, we need to understand these technologies from a little bit more abstract perspective as well. Now, I'm trying to discuss this a little bit with you in my talk, and I will partially refer back to some of the techniques that you have already seen in this course. So, but first of all, let me share a few words upon who am I. So, thanks a lot for this accurate introduction. So, I'm working with Vienna University of Economics and Business. It's kind of a clumsy name. Therefore, I'm very forgiving for all of you who might actually not exactly remember the exact spelling of the words of our university in English. But in German, it's much easier. It's simply called Wirtschaftsuniversität. And I hope this is easier to remember. This institution is in the heart of Vienna, as you can see in this little photo. We are neighboring to the Prater Park, for those of you who may have been to Vienna. We are, two things that are maybe not so obvious. First, we are not the business school of the University of Vienna, but we are an independent university. And with that, what is maybe also not obvious, we are an independent university that is publicly funded. Yeah? So the origins of this school date back to imperial times, that by the turn, by the end of the 19th century, the Austrian imperial administration discovered the need to more substantially educate their merchants back at that time. In formal business concepts, and that gave birth to what was then the Imperial Expert Academy, which later became Wirtschaftsuniversität, so Vienna University of Economics and Business. So my interests in research are business process management, enterprise systems, process mining, to name few of the major topics. The research that we conduct at our institute is applying computer science techniques, but also uses we use research methods from the empirical social sciences. So we also run experiments and we conduct surveys or qualitative case studies in order to understand new technologies and how they interplay with executing processes. So I also want to know a little bit upon yourself. So who would you classify yourself? So is there somebody who would actually say that, well, I'm from a business perspective, I'm doing management, or I'm interested in development, or maybe I want to aspire to later become a business analyst, or you simply would say I'm a student. So is there anybody who would say, well, I am more interested in the business side of this topic? Is there anybody who would say, I'm interested in the technical, in the computer science perspective on the topic? And anybody of you working part-time? If so, full-time? Anybody working full-time? Agnes?
Yes, full-time.
That is one of the things that we discussed a little bit earlier. This is something that I find interesting, that in Vienna, many of our students, they work either part-time or full-time. And they forget a little bit looking deeper into their studies. So I very much appreciate that nobody of you is actually working full time. Okay, great. Thanks a lot. It gives me a little bit of a picture. Right. Oh, I actually should have put Kiel here. I also want to know where you're from. So is anybody who's from Kiel? Anybody who is from Schleswig-Holstein? Anybody who is from Germany? Anybody who is from the European Union? Anybody who is from somewhere else? All right. Somewhere else? Let's say Asia, Asian countries? Yeah. African countries? American countries? Australia, Pacific? Oh, okay, great. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Okay, good. So with this a little intro, I'd like to start with from a perspective of, let's say, where are we standing? Yeah. So this lecture is discussing new technologies that have some potential for executing processes. And I'd like to summarize a little bit from my view that we have kind of a starting point upon which we, I don't know, hopefully agree. Where these new technologies, how we can look at them, and what is currently going on. And I think there are various trends that are very important to recognize when it comes to executing processes. And loosely, some of them are associated with what you see on this picture here. And many of these trends here, they change the way how certain industries do their business. So, briefly from my point of view, so you have on the left-hand side Google Cars, and there are also other companies on the market that try out autonomous driving. Yeah, so it is guided or fully independent. So Tesla may be one of the companies that you can see also in this pocket. This is changing the way how we drive cars, right? Second, how do we fuel cars? We are currently in a, at least as it seems, in a transition period where we change over from combustion towards electric powering of cars. So that is also a major change in, on the one hand side, which kind of skills are required for building these cars, but also how, which kind of scenarios we're going to use them. Yeah, so. Car sharing is one of the applications that is facilitated by using information systems to organize the usage of cars. Fudora, is there something like an offering here in Kiel that compares to Fudora or Delivery Hero or something like this? Yeah. Who has ordered a pizza or some sushi or Indian food with these offerings? So apparently also there, we use IT for organizing how we actually have what we have on the table. Yeah. Left-hand side, so Adidas is one of the companies that not only trying out 3D printing of shoes, but there are actually stores already where you can benefit from that. So they measure your feet and these shoes are tailor-made to your feet. It's not on large scale available right now, but there are actually shops where this is already being done. Also there, IT plays a role from sensing and measurement towards actually the tailoring of the goods. Who uses Netflix or Amazon Prime? Anybody does? Yeah? None of you guys? you don't dare saying. So, well, sure, that this on-demand usage of TV series and movies is different to how we have done it 20 years ago. Yeah? And finally, I'm sure you talked about bitcoins in this class before. Have you? Yeah. Yes. All right. See some nodding heads. Well, that's a different way of how we organize financial transfers. So, and what is interesting about all of these things is that on the one hand, these new offerings, these new opportunities, they look strikingly different to what we have done in the past. On the other hand, They're also extremely similar in a certain way, since you still eat your favorite pizza, you still transfer your euros to somebody else's account, you're still watching TV, you're still using a car to go from A to B. So at a certain abstraction level, these things are still the same. Yeah. And what is different is that the processes, how we use them, the processes, how we consume those goods and services, these are changing, and these are strikingly different. And they're strikingly different because we make use of IT and opportunities of how we can design processes by the use of IT. And I think that's very important. And that emphasizes what is actually the key thing about this process perspective that we often talk about. Yeah? Processes are how we do things, and IT is fundamental to the question of how we do things. Yeah? So using IT for organizing processes differently is the key to explain why all these new services have been emerging. So, and this is an observation that is not by itself is not new, and you see here on this slide a reference to a research work in innovation management, and that's the classical Utterberg-Abernathy model from a little bit earlier than I was born, yeah, but not that much earlier, and that explains how. Usually life cycles of products or services are evolving over time. And this chart simply says that this stage of development is in essence a time axis. Yeah, so if a new offering emerges, let's say like self-driving cars, or like Netflix, or the first smart iPhone where you could actually use touch screens to navigate through your phone, when such a new offering emerges, we are kind of at the zero point of this axis. Yeah? So it means the first day when there was Netflix, we were standing here. And then anything that emerges over time would typically follow this pattern that the product side is the first thing that drives the innovation around this, and also the uptake of a new technology. So if it was the iPhone, very early, you see that this was a drastically new way of how you could actually telephone. And therefore, this curve here of product innovation starts very high and sharply. And you see that how this is declining. And I have kind of an old iPhone somewhere. I'm like Agnes, I'm losing things. I think it's somewhere in my pocket. And if you look at this iPhone, I have an iPhone from the Series 5, which is definitely not the most recent, but also not the most oldest series of iPhones. If you compare that to the very first one, it doesn't really look so differently than the first one. Yeah, so it's already actually quite similar, and the design is already quite stable, so we are kind of actually have already slipped down this product innovation curve quite far. And you see this is slowing down more and more. And if you have an iPhone 9 and an iPhone 10, and well, I think you still have to look carefully to understand is this now the new one or the old one. So it still looks very similar. So this product innovation is sharply declining, and what over time then becomes extremely important is the way how we innovate our processes around this. And that's actually what makes the key why we look into process innovation, and why process innovation is actually the fuel of much of the innovation that we see these days. Yeah? So many of the markets in our economy are saturated, but when something is new, it is very often that it is the new way of doing things, and it's not the substance that is new. Yeah? So therefore, actually, it's a good idea to be in this class, because here you hear all these things, how this works. So, and there are different levels of how these innovations are unfolding, and you can look at them from, let's say, the very, let's say, micro task level, and I want to start with that level, towards a very broad and large scale process level. So, and what we see these days that very often new technologies, they first find their way into the way how we actually look at particular types of tasks. And when you see how IT actually works, at many stages, IT has been concerned in the past that we want to do actually something about the routine cognitive tasks. Is there anybody who have seen this Hollywood movie on the ladies that work for NASA? Does anybody know that movie? It's a movie from that refers back to the time of the 1960s. It's also dealing with racism in the south of the U.S. And there are these three colored women. And they do all the computations in many of the projects of the NASA Apollo teams. And that's actually great to see because that movie, beyond all the other societal issues that it raises, it clarifies a little bit how computers have changed certain ways of how we do things. And it started all here in this routine cognitive tasks. And I think these days, and I'm sure you guys are also like myself, people who were brought up at school, you had like a pocket calculator, right? Did anybody have a pocket calculator? Yeah. So you're already used from your childhood days that you have, I don't know, like a five-digit number and you want to multiply it with something else. You type it in and then you get the result. Fantastic, yeah? So in this movie that refers back to the 60s, that shows these ladies sitting in a whole department at NASA, a room like this. I don't know, maybe 20, 30 young ladies, and they're calculating such things. They're doing like differential equations, etc., and sinuses, cosinuses, etc., and they calculate that by hand or by head. Yeah. So and indeed, around these years, they had their first IBM computer at NASA, also in a room much larger than this, where they had this computer installed, and you see how their work is changing from these human calculators. So these persons were called calculators, computers. And it was essentially about that computers took over this task of doing these routine calculations. Yeah? Because calculating a sinus, etc., is something that's, well, it is always the same. It's the same procedure how you do that. And computers are great in this. So this is what we have been seeing for decades. Yeah. And what is happening these days is that you see that this sphere of computerization is expanding in different directions. So on the one hand, you see that routine manual tasks are now also becoming more and more subject to computerization, as much as non-routine cognitive tasks are also increasingly becoming subject to computerization. And I want to give you a few examples for this. So let's talk about non-routine cognitive tasks. What is a non-routine cognitive task? Well, non-routine is something that is usually described in terms of the knowledge that is required to do it. Yeah. So if it is a non-routine cognitive task, it is usually a task that requires deep and extensive expertise in a certain field. Like, for instance, if you're a neuroscientist, you could actually make sense of these pictures. Yeah. So these pictures may show you some alerting regions that may be symptoms of a certain brain illness. But I'm not of that kind. I don't know. So for me, they're just like pictures. Yeah. And the challenges is for people who do diagnosis in hospitals, to routinely and continuously look at these pictures and try to understand if this is a condition that indicates a tumor that may actually eventually even require surgery. Yeah. And this is a very complicated task because the information you have here shows you certain conditions, but you still have to assess not only what is in the picture, but also which kind of background conditions the patient has and so forth. And then you diagnose and you make suggestions of how this is going to be treated. So, and the task by itself is complex because, well, every brain scan is different, and it's also something that, let's say, these brain scans and brain images, which are not so easily to approach from a reductionist perspective, that you could say, well, I don't know, let's say, how colorful the overall picture is, the more likely it is that there's some malicious condition. Yeah. So it's a very complicated, multidimensional matter that we're dealing with. And it is one of the benefits of many of the machine learning techniques that they are able to train their judgment based on many previous examples of brain scans in order to indicate that there may be something indicating or pointing to a tumor. Yeah? And that's a typical example of such a non-routine cognitive task that is these days becoming more and more computerized, because on the one hand, we have all this example data of brain scans available electronically. So these are these days not being done anymore with analogous picturing technologies. And we also have we know about these cases that we can train these images if they actually show something malicious or not. So it means we have something like gold standard data that help us to understand if this picture is good or bad. And if you can learn this from 100,000 images of brain scans, then this is something that actually help you to automate this task. I don't want to talk much more about AI, but I think this is something that let's say it's very typical for AI applications these days. I would assess that maybe 98% of AI applications are very specifically focused on a particular task, and where, let's say, what actually is the misleading in the term AI is it's more about actually the classification for performance that makes these technologies here so suitable. And if they're intelligent or not, I don't know, that may be a matter of discussion. So it's essentially what makes up this technology and is their performance actually in doing such classification tasks. So that's on the non-routine cognitive task side, and you have also tasks that are on the manual task side. So these are tasks that typically have been done by people. Has anybody ever worked in a warehouse? So a warehouse looks like this. So in a warehouse, or maybe has anybody been to IKEA? Yeah. So IKEA is also kind of a mixture between a shop and a warehouse. Yeah? So if you then find your way out of the IKEA through these long aisles and these huge halls, this is essentially how a warehouse looks like. So if it is not IKEA, it is usually the company that actually gets the different products from the shelves of this warehouse and packages them up in order, for example, to deliver them to you, for example, by postal service or somehow else. So, and the typical proceeding is that classically such an order, if you had something ordered by Amazon, let's say 15 years ago, somebody in the warehouse would actually look at, sheet of paper, Agnes has ordered 10 copies of this and this book. So somebody would actually walk, for example, yeah? Somebody would actually walk into the warehouse at the particular shelves, get 10 of these pocket books, and actually wrap them up. Yeah? So, and there have been different levels how this has been computerized at different stages. So the first thing was that companies introduced bar scans to keep track of who's packaging up what in which boxes. So people had like these arm scanners with which they can actually scan these labels And in this way, that could support the process to update where somebody's taking something out of the shelves. So, and also this year, it's also not so recent anymore. I think these pictures are from 2015, when Amazon increasingly computerized their warehouse operations, and it's now robots being used in different sections of these warehouses. And this little friendly guy here that looks a little bit like your vacuum cleaner, this is a lifting robot, so that thing can run around. And you see here these markings on the ground, and that guy can actually then move somewhere and see, okay, I have to lift up this package here of goods, and I have to bring it somewhere else. Yeah. So this task has been computerized in that way, and they're continuously innovating around this. So also there, you see that these manual tasks, so tasks that have people been doing physically in the past, they're continuously becoming subject to such computerization. So, and well, where is this all ending up? There is a nice study that discusses, how much or what is this supposedly doing to the labor market? So these colleagues here, Frey and Osborne. Frey is a Swedish guy who's working in Oxford in economics, and he looked into this question with his colleague Osborne, who is a guy actually from computer science. And they tried to use different sources of data in order to come up at least with some sort of an assessment which kind of jobs to which extent will actually fall subject to that computerization. Different types of jobs are indicated with these different colors here. And you see a spectrum that they span up from 0 to 1, where 1 is a maximum probability of computerization. So I think this is important to say that this is not the share, but it's the probability of computerization. And you see that some jobs are fairly, let's say, exposed to potential computerization. In particular, so this red block here is sales and related. This red here is services. And when you see some of, let's say, the technologies that you've been discussing, so for instance, RPA was mentioned in this course. And when you think about, for example, how salespeople these days manually handle incoming emails, and you may be able to program with UiPath some smart little script who's able to pre-classify 98% of emails and route them to the right persons. And you see a little bit here what makes up this block. Similar vein here, this orange block here is office and administrative support. So these are things where the techniques that you're discussing here in this class will have for sure an impact already today and even more tomorrow. So I'm not sure, and how far it is biased, that of course these two guys are researchers, that when you look here on the left-hand side of this spectrum, that education and also healthcare are assumed to be not so much a victim of this computerization. Then maybe you can, maybe this creates some ideas of where your career can lead you. So, like, for instance, if you become further expert in robotic process automation, well, these may be actually interesting sectors to focus upon. And maybe it's interesting also to pursue a career that is more on the left-hand side here. Right. But still, well, there's the term is probability of computerization. And also, well, it's, of course, a little bit unclear how all this will materialize. And I think one thing is important, that we're talking here about the computerization of tasks. And then people discuss about what does that mean for the labor market. Yeah? And when you look at employment and jobs, usually jobs are much more coarse-grained than tasks. Yeah, so anything that is maybe here becoming taken over by computers are very likely, even if it is a lot, only fragments of what is the actual jobs of many people in the job market. So at least that's my personal take. I'm not so much afraid for that. There will be changes. But if you look a little bit into the literature, you find a lot of lament in IT killing jobs in the 1960s. And when you see that we still have work and we don't have it boring, that maybe we shouldn't be so much afraid about this. So there are a lot of opportunities, and these technologies will definitely change the way how we actually organize and set up processes. So, what particular technologies do I want to a little bit discuss with you? First one was already mentioned, robotic process automation. And I know that you guys have already seen a little bit how that works. Well, the nice pitch about robotic process automation is how some people say, take the robot out of the human. Yeah, so let's get all the stupid work away from us, such that we can focus on the intelligent and nice things, where we can be creative and think certain things through. So it means, in essence, robotic process automation has the effect that much of these cumbersome tasks that we also would refer to as routine tasks, that we find a way of scripting them out, such that some RPA robot is able to do this. Yeah? So it makes us faster, so we can actually fill out our travel requests, fill out our bookings of classes or book enrollment for classes at the university. All right, paper. Oh yes, yes, we did it already. Yes, we had to move paper for that. So with this technologies, you can actually be faster with that. The second type of technology, which is also subject to this class, is blockchain technology. And the part about blockchain, what I find interesting, is the fact that we can use smart contracts to predefine how certain processes are supposed to unfold between different parties. Yeah? And I think this is even much more powerful than just moving money from A to B. Because we can come into an agreement with another party that we do not know, that we want to do business in a certain way, where, I don't know, I consume a certain service, like having a transfer to Hamburg Airport by the Kiel Express shuttle service, and they will receive some payment based on the delivery of that. And if they don't trust me, if I have the money, and I don't trust them if they really do that delivery, we can freeze in the payment for that in a smart contract, and it will be automatically paid when we agree that this service has been delivered. So, of course, for something like a standard small amount service like this shuttle transfer, this is maybe not so interesting. But when you think about larger supply chain scenarios where people across different countries being subject to different legal regulations may want to agree upon that certain things have to happen in a certain order based on certain requirements, then this is a scenario where blockchain technology is becoming very interesting. So, and the nice thing is, and that's the reason why you find here a BPMN diagram here on this slide, there are techniques that you can, with which you can use such a BPMN specification and automatically translate that into the skeletons of respective smart contracts. Yeah, so it means we at least partially are getting away that those people who want to set up such smart contracts, that they have to know all the technical details of how, for example, Ethereum works. And we can lift the abstraction level and make people who design these processes much more productive. So in the third type of technology that I find interesting, which is having its imprint in this whole process execution and process automation sphere, is process mining. I think this is not explicitly subject of this lecture, but I think you have covered in a previous lecture a little bit of how you can go from blockchain data towards process mining. The idea is with process mining that you use event log data. These are recordings in information systems of different steps that we have executed in the process. And with this data, we can, on the one hand, automatically generate such diagrams that you see here on the right-hand side. And you can also check if you already have such a diagram, if what has happened is actually consistent with this. Yeah, so that may actually also help you to discover where something happened that you do not want to happen. And in this way, process mining is a very good technology to give you really evidence-based insights into where performance issues of your process are, or where also conformance issues, so compliance issues, are in your processes. So these technologies are very important these days, and they're intensively discussed. And those companies who are offering tools and services around this are extremely high valued if they're already on the stock market or if they are in more senior venture capital fundings. There's one of the more recent numbers was that the process mining company called Celonis, located in Munich, they are valued these days with 2.5 billion in euros, and they have a tool simply for doing process mining. Yeah, so the guys who have started that company, they have been students like you less than 10 years ago. They heard about that technology in one of their classes, and I think in 2012, around that time, they started Celonis, so they prototyped their first tool themselves. And, now this company is so highly valued and high priced. Also, UiPath. UiPath is an interesting case because the key person in UiPath is a Romanian. And he started UiPath in Bucharest, and they're by far the only startup in Romania that is so highly valued. So they are currently taxed of something like 4 billion euros. So even with that, you see that a specific niche that you discover and certain knowledge of certain technology, you do not even require to be in a country like Germany, but you can also do that in Romania, for example, which is a country which is maybe not the most favorite one if you look how much stress there was in the recent years on the political system due to corruption, etc. So even that, I think, only emphasizes how powerful these technologies are and how much with a good understanding of the fundamentals you can go in creating something on your own, maybe. I don't know. Is anybody thinking about that? I want to do something on my own? All right. Yeah. It's possible. Yeah. All right. So, and the last point that I want to emphasize is that there is a discussion about what's actually the impact of IT? And I want to discuss this next a little bit further in detail. But there was a lot of confusion in the 1990s. And the 1990s was the decade where much of the IT that we these days observe as commodity have been becoming really like broader used, like laptops, desktop computers, windowing systems, and all those standard software like Word, etc., or emailing systems that we have on every computer, that was taking up in the 1990s. And there was a lot of confusion about with those people who looked at it from an economic perspective, because classical economics would typically argue, well, if you invest in a new technology and that is used, then you should actually see an increasement in productivity. And funny enough, and that was these big studies by Brynjolfsson and others, economists that focus on technology at MIT, they discovered that actually there's not so much actually about that these IT investments of companies translate themselves into productivity improvements. And that was really a puzzle. How can that be? You invest in IT and you don't see productivity improvements. And I ask you guys, how can that be? You invest in IT and you don't see any productivity improvements. Strange, huh?
Maybe the market is not ready for the technology.
All right. Market's not ready. What does that mean? I think the direction is good. So think you are, let's assume you're a middle-sized company located here in Kiel. And I don't know, let's assume your studies are done. You're being hired as something like the second man behind the person who is responsible for IT. And now you see, oh, there's RPA. So let's do it here. Huh? And you start rolling out RPA in that company. And then you see this productivity product. Paradox. A lot of investment, it doesn't pay off. How can that be? Right, I give you a few hints. So first thing is, well, technology, all right.
Automating the wrong stuff, maybe, not knowing, okay, which process to make.
All right.
It may take less time, but it may will spend a lot of time creating it, but it may take a very less time in reality when people actually do it. So maybe there was no need to automate. Maybe you automate the wrong stuff.
Very good point. Yes. And there are actually two things in your answer that I want to untangle. First thing is, if we introduce a new technology, first of all, such that it reaps its benefits, it has to be used. Yeah. So I know a very funny story, and it's as sad as funny. It's a company that we've been in touch with. This company is not from Germany, and there's a clear reason why I don't mention the name. And this company did the following. It was 2017, and they discovered there's process mining. Whoa, fantastic. So what did they do? The guys in the process department, they got actually the backing from their senior management and said, like, well, we have to invest this money in process mining. Yeah. What happened? They bought a license for Celonis, a tool that is really not so cheap. And what did they do with it? Nothing. They did nothing with that. And that's already 2 years ago. So the only thing that happens with the Celonis tool right now in that company is they're paying each year the software license. So it means, first of all, IT has to be used and it has to be made useful such that it actually can leave an impact. Yeah. So simply for the fact that they have process mining, so they have it, but they don't have it. Yeah. So they have it, they bought it, so the investment is there, but they didn't do anything with that. Yeah. So, and I think this is partially an answer to this paradox here. Also in the 1990s, there may be a lot of companies that actually jumped on that there's this new fancy technology. They bought licenses and they did not really use it. Either not at all, or maybe not at the extent that it could actually become productive. And the second thing is, and I think this is what you emphasized more, is the point how you use it. Even if you use it, how you use it. And that's actually a very big discussion around RPA, for example, where some of the more classical, educated let's say process experts, they say, well, maybe the idea is stupid to take a bad process and simply automate it. Maybe let's first make the process better and maybe simpler, and then automate it. Yeah? And then the productivity, you could actually already argue, well, how much of the share of this improvement is now due to that the process is simpler or better, and the respective software that supports it. So it means in many stages, when you see where IT really left a strong impact, it is because IT was used with, at the same time, revising and redesigning the processes. And that's usually the variable in the middle, the mediator. You invest in IT, and IT then gives you the impact if you do something with your processes. Yeah? If you change your processes and make that better. So, and this is something actually that I also look at very critically these days. So I'm not sure how much you follow German press. There's currently, again, another wave of discussion, the politicians in the South are pushing for that we should invest more in digitalization of IT in the public sector. And, well, that makes me sigh a bit because, I think the best accelerator for digitalization would be to not invest more money, but actually to make a whole bunch of regulations much more simple in this country. And then there's maybe only 30% of what you need to digitalize. And that by itself actually would leverage the investments that are being done there. And if you have simpler rules and simpler processes, you get there much faster with the same investment of IT. Yeah? All right, so that means, well, I think this is the key to this puzzle of the paradox. So the investments in IT pay off when they have an impact on the way how the processes change. And if the processes are better, this is actually where productivity comes from. All right, so that's kind of what I think is going on these days in many dimensions. So now let's look a little bit of what we can do with this to understand a bit better which kind of technologies are interesting for us. So, for that, I try to refer a little bit to this life cycle model that we have in our textbook, since I believe the process perspective is important for understanding where IT makes sense and how we can actually use it effectively. So, and from this life cycle perspective, comes a little bit the thinking towards what are those processes which might potentially benefit from IT, and then the question, how are they going to benefit from that? So, I think we need to talk about these two things separately. So, first of all, we need to understand what the technologies that we're looking at can do for us. And that's, I think, the biggest challenge when you look at many of these, let's say, business observers like Gartner and the hype cycles, etc. Every half a year, you get like a new list of 24 of technologies. We don't know what they are and what they can do. So you need to actually look at them from a more abstract perspective of principles. And I think the principles, and this is also another reason why I selected these three technologies beforehand, and these principles are, I believe, these here, and they can more or less be associated with RPA and the other technologies that we have already discussed. So what IT can do, first thing is IT can automate. Sounds very simple, but we have to be clear about there are certain IT that cannot automate. Yeah, and therefore it's important to ask ourselves, in how far is this IT that we're looking at able to automate passages of the processes that we want to improve? So if there is an automation effect, it can potentially make our processes faster, it can make them better scalable, and in this way it can also reduce our cost of operating these processes. And that's pretty much the classical pitch that, let's say, an RPA salesperson would give you. Yeah? Clearly, we automate some existing process, and RPA helps us do this. Second, is transformational. And transformational effects are now interesting to separate from the automation effects, because here, when I talk here about automation, it is, let's say, more or less a task focus. So how we discussed, like routine, non-routine, cognitive, manual task, etc. RPA is helping us to do some of these things. So we have some of the tasks that we can automate. Transformational is now a question of coordination. So here we look at how do different companies interact in a company. And that's then a question that is a little bit more difficult to grasp and think through. A question of in how far a new process technology can help us to organize and interact with our partners differently. And clearly this is a scenario that is made for blockchain. So instead of having different companies exchanging EDI messages and engaging in cumbersome and extensive paper-based contracting, they may make use of smart contracts to collaborate with each other. And the transformation then actually materializes on the coordination level, right? And that's not individual task, but it is actually how we actually make commitments with one another. So, and the third matter is informational effects. Informational effects relate to the fact that IT can help us to see things better. Better means more precisely, more clearly, more detailedly. And process mining is exactly in this pocket. It's a technology that makes details of processes visible, how we have not been able to see them before. And this is very important for us to have an understanding as humans of that process. And pretty much many of the things that are in let's say, in the business intelligence sphere belong to this category that provide informational effects. And the important point is when you discover that a certain technology can provide you with informational effects, you see that this can be very beneficial, but you also see that the impact scenario with that tool alone is incomplete. Yeah? Simply for the fact that I know something better, my process doesn't change. Yeah? So I still need to do something about my process. If I want to make my processes better, well, process mining informs me where and how I might actually focus on, but it doesn't change the processes. Yeah? So I still need my my project teams to actually reprogram the processes, to analyze them, to reorganize them, to write new guidelines, etc., in order to make these benefits materialize. So this is important with all these technologies that are just like continuously being thrown onto the market. These are three questions that you can ask them. Are you a technology that helps me to automate? Are you a technology to transform the way how we coordinate? Are you a technology that informs me better? Yeah? And RPA, blockchain, process mining, they may be actually more or less in these categories. There may be other ones in the future, but this is fairly generic. So, and these three pockets are also not made out of my mind. I must emphasize this. This stems from a research paper that colleagues published in 1996. Yeah, and you see in this way, well, if it can be still be applied here, that this seems to be fairly generic. Yeah. Right. So with this in mind, how can we look at the processes in our company? So and this more or less steps us now through the different stages of the BPM lifecycle. First, we ask ourselves what it is actually, how does it actually relate to our level of process identification? And that means we can actually approach this from a very high level perspective in getting a first understanding what we might want to focus on. So a high-level description of processes is usually being done in companies, let's say, with something that is called a process map, for example, or a list of what are the major processes of a company. Yeah? And there are some generic lists that standard bodies have developed. Here this APQC process framework says that more or less at which other company you may want to look, any company will have these 13 processes more or less specified for them in case they are relevant for them. You see some of them here relate to physical products, and you know, sure, some companies don't have physical products, so then these categories are not relevant. But any company will have to think about what is our vision and strategy. What are the things that we try to develop and manage? What are the things that we try to market and sell? And so forth and so forth. As much as some of the usual support functions, well, how do we actually manage our human resources? How do we manage our IT? How do we manage our finance, etc., etc.? So it means with this understanding, we can now actually take our lists like this, or a more specific list that we have for our company. And we can ask ourselves, where is a certain technology relevant for us? And we can do this for a university, of course. So for a university, we can ask ourselves, where is a technology like, for example, RPA or blockchain, where could it be relevant? Yeah. So if we, for example, take RPA, we may ask ourselves, where can we actually benefit from the fact that we have to move information between different IT systems? And you may then go through this list and ask yourself, well, here at Kiel University, where is actually cumbersome work that I have to do, or that my professors have to do, or their secretaries, when it comes to move information from one system to another? Yeah? And these categories may help you a little bit, and you may, for example, discover that when it comes to, let's say, managing customer service, so that means like from a professor or secretary perspective, anything that is like student interaction, getting people enrolled into different classes, etc., maybe there's a potential to think about how RPA can actually help us to get rid of some of the routine work there. Yeah. So that may be a first high-level assessment that in a certain pocket, a certain technology may be interesting for us. Same questions we can ask us for blockchain. Well, do you know any scenario where blockchain could be relevant for a university? If you were the rector of the university, where would you use blockchain, if at all? All right, with exam certification, yes. And this is, this is indeed something that many universities are considering these days. So that is, let's say, you could actually relate this to the delivery of services or the marketing and selling of services. Many universities are, for example, discussing to interchange grades with blockchain technology. Their first consortia who do this, that, for example, if you go on exchange with Erasmus to a university abroad, that you would not have to actually bring papers, but the universities would automatically exchange the certificates that you have acquired in the different courses. Huh? Is one of the scenarios that is being discussed. So with process mining, where could process mining be useful for a university? Well, it may help us to see some things that we do not see so well these days. Yeah. So for us in Vienna, and that's related to the delivery of services, we have a quite sophisticated e-learning system where students not only find the slides but where there's a series of self-learning questions and through the way how the people actually let's say work through the courses as much as it is visible through these systems, you can understand a little bit how people do things in a course, But on the bigger scale, you can also see from the grid administration system what are the typical sequences of courses that students take, and what would be desired or undesired paths, and process mining might actually show you that. And from this, you may then think about, are there ways how we can actually innovate and change our curriculum such that students not so much anymore get stuck with that and that course when in that and that phase of their studies. Yeah? So this is a scenario where process mining could actually be applied. All right. So when it comes then to the administration and discovery of existing processes, we can take, for example, a more detailed perspective where we then want to find out how these technologies may actually help us to improve processes. And I pick one of the processes that I don't know how much you are familiar with that, but it's a process that is actually a very difficult one at our university. That is the process of admission to master's programs. I'm not sure how it runs here. Just a few words how that runs in Vienna. According to Austrian law, master's studies that are offered in English can actually do an admission process. And an admission process is a process where you apply and you're either accepted or you are rejected. And this accepting or rejecting depends on a certain threshold because the respective studies, they would have a certain capacity of seats. Yeah. So and if the material with which you apply is among, let's say, the best 60 applicants, you would be offered a seat. The process is difficult because, well, you can think of, well, if I'm a student and I want to apply there and I don't know if they accept me, what do you do? Well, I would expect you also apply somewhere else. And maybe at another place as well. And maybe at a fourth place. Yeah? Such that you can be sure that you get a seat. So what happens then? Well, university actually gives out the 60 offers. Then, let's say, a certain amount of students says, yes, here we are. And maybe, let's say, somewhere between 10% to 30% of these students will say, well, you know, I still wait if I get the seat at this other uni. Or they directly say, well, I already have a seat somewhere else, I'm not coming. So this is a difficult process. Yeah? So and therefore this process is an actually also a good one to discuss different stages and to identify how technology can help us there, because it's a process. Yeah. So how can we analyze this process? So this is now classical BPM. Well, you would want to identify what are the issues. Yeah, so in a standard BPM methodology, you would analyze with different sort of methods. So that could be also like brainstorming or interviewing stakeholders in the process. You would want to actually identify what are the issues and how people deal with these issues and how can you want to fix them. But it's one of the issues of the students maybe that they see the risk that they're going to be rejected. Or that the offer from the university is being rejected. And there may be different factors that explain that maybe it took too long, or the student choose another university, or they change their mind, or they don't want to relocate, etc., or they don't get a visa, and so forth. So there may be many reasons why actually somebody is not taking the offer that the university is offering. So, with that in mind, we can now ask ourselves what may actually these technologies contribute to that process. Yeah? So if we look at RPA, we identified one of the issues that this process may actually take long. The reason why this process takes long is partially due to the fact that all kinds of different checks have to be done. Yeah? So the first passage of the process is dedicated towards checking the documents. And these documents, they have to be correct, they have to be consistent, they have to be verified, and they also have to demonstrate that all the different thresholds are being positively passed. So, for example, if there's a required level of English, you have to have a TOEFL test, and that TOEFL test has to have a certain amount of points, and so forth. Yeah. So all these things are being checked these days manually at our university. Yeah, you can imagine that this is maybe not the most lucky task. If you have to check 3,000 applications, if the TOEFL requirements are met, yeah, and it's also a little bit stupid when you think about it. All these applicants, they send in their documents electronically, and then somebody is actually manually or visually looking at that. Yeah? RPA may actually be a tool that is useful to do some of these checks automatically. Yeah, so and then we have an impact on that process. So that may actually make this whole procedure a lot faster. Yeah? So transformational effects. How could that be? A scenario may be that we require these different university transcript of records, etc., to be verified. Well, sounds like blockchain, right? So if the outgoing universities would actually provide the students already with electronic blockchain-based certificates, it would be very easy to verify that actually these documents are correct and safe. Yeah. Again, of course, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem, because we in Vienna would be very interested if the universities who are sending our students would actually do that. Yeah? And this is something that you have to solve differently. But if that was available, that would also have a very good impact on this process. So in the informational effects, and this is also something where blockchain technology may make help us to make some things more transparent in the process. We currently do not understand so much when and how long we have to wait for somebody, for example, to accept an offer. How people interact. There are a lot of emails interchanged. If there would be a way of making this whole journey of the student through the application process better visible, that would be something where we would see things that we don't know today. Yeah? And if we would understand, okay, we lose the students in this phase of the process, and that would be something where we can then actually make good investments and improve while neglecting the other parts of the process. So process mining may be a way actually that helps us to do this. All right, so with that understanding, we can then actually start redesigning the process. Let's say a decision has been made that we're going to use RPA, and then the question is how. Yeah, so this then comes down to the real implementation project. And, well, let's say, demanding our creativity. And this is something that these tools, of course, also do not say. You can use RPA, you can use blockchain in a very smart and clever way, but also in a very dumb way. And this is, in the end, a matter of design and understanding the different users that are involved in the process and their requirements upon the process. It's one of my favorite pictures here, because that emphasize that actually many processes from a customer perspective are like this. And I'm afraid that I hope I don't bash you in Kiel, because I think this is the same at every university. Much of the student processes look like this. Well, here, let's say the tab on the left and the right are different functions in the university administration. Yeah? So, but understanding the process is then actually the key actually to mix the cold and the warm water. So how can we do that? Yeah, sure. It's always good to understand on which dimension we want to improve. I think that's the first and foremost key thing. For instance, if it is here for our application process, we would have a very strong emphasis here on time. So we want to get faster. Yeah? There may be different patterns how we're going to do this. So some of our colleagues have been working on that. But there may be more specific patterns of improvement maybe emerging over time when people more and more use RPA or blockchain, etc., and that there are specific ways of how these technologies can improve things. There are also various methods that go beyond. So it's not only about changing technically the process, but understanding the requirements. Many of the techniques that move towards design thinking are putting more emphasis on the creative side and require us to understand what do the customers and stakeholders of the process really need. And this is, of course, key when you talk about processes that have some sort of external customer. Maybe I keep this short. There are different redesign heuristics that we also discuss in our book, and they are able to help with one or the other design dimension of the process. And that comes down to how actually we are going to use techniques like, for example, RPA. And we can do this in a smart and dull way, as being said. So when we already actually start changing and implementing the process, we might actually think about those simple things like that we can, by the help of IT, make things parallel that have been sequential in the past, like doing signatures. Very simple thing. So also in terms of cost, once we start automating, it may also be that we observe that certain activities are not needed anymore. Yeah? So that saves costs by eliminating those activities where the IT by themselves can actually fill in here. Also, some matters will be just like of better quality. And I think many blockchain scenarios would be of that case, because these days, companies interchange data either with electronic messaging or even on paper. And once you're able to do this with blockchain technology, that will be instantaneous. And you know that it is the data that both parties agree upon. So finally, flexibility. That may be something where process mining gives us some transparency of those passages of the process where we need more flexibility or we have to be more standardized. But that's just one of the scenarios where process mining makes sense as well. Maybe I skip over this. These are some of our student works. We had some students who tried to actually make this admission process better by some prototyping of chatbots, and there are some tools for doing that. And sketching out some potential interfaces, and we're currently working on that to make this a smoother and faster process. Actually, we already have in our electronic certificates digital signatures, so we're currently also investigating how much extra effort that is to bring this onto the blockchain, but the cryptographic techniques are fairly similar. Right, so then you still have to implement. I think this is standard business then, and in the end, once the process is up and running, you can monitor. So with this, I want to wrap up that new technologies are important for us to understand of what they can do for us. First of all, on a very high level, where we ask ourselves the question, what are the technologies that we want to look at? And those that we find interesting and relevant, we have to ask us very specifically in the light of a specific process, how we're going to implement them. So and these two perspectives together help us to deal with the knowledge gap that we have when all these new technologies emerge. Right, so that means, well, maybe this is like a broader conclusion. So how are we going to manage business processes in the future? And that's at least what I believe, it will be pretty much as what Fry and Osborne say, these guys from the economic study of how computerization influences many of our daily jobs. They say the extent of computerization in the 21st century will thus partially depend on the innovative approaches to task restructuring. Yeah? So you see here again, technology leaves its impact by the way how we use it to change tasks and how we change processes. So the technology by itself cannot do that. It requires us to think about how we can actually use it in a smart way. We've seen some examples. And I think as such, the story is pretty much the same as we had it in the beginning of the 20th century. When, for example, the assembly line found its way into practice, we have to ask ourselves how certain technologies provide capabilities that we can use in an interesting way. And this influences the way how our processes will be changing. And this is where the benefits then materialize. With that, I want to close. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Questions?
Comments are equally appreciated. Otherwise, we have questions. Yeah, please.
So, on the one hand, that some companies might fall prey to the idea that, you know, they automate the wrong stuff. It could also be that since they did not have good evaluation techniques, they didn't see the potential of what else got automated. While they automated the wrong stuff. A very primitive example, I'm sure most more sophisticated examples is like an employee attendance system where every day an employee comes in and they just write a beep on a chart.
Yep.
Right. It doesn't take long. They just have to write a beep. There are no long lines. So nothing really gets more productive. But there are side effects, which could be like, you know, days off, calculation of days off gets easier because all the information gets recorded. Does this happen a lot that, you know, since we don't have evaluation methodologies, we think that we've automated the wrong stuff and we potentially don't see the rest of the stuff that automatically gets automated, and we tend to get the benefit of that. How does one avoid that?
That's a good observation. Yeah. So it's definitely a question about the boundaries of the system that you're looking at. And I think much of, let's say, the more business-oriented IT is of a kind as you say it. Yeah. So there are certain requirements on the casual workers such that the managers can do a better job. And this is indeed a matter of struggle where... then the managers are trying to force, let's say, the normal workforce to use technology that maybe they don't see too much of a benefit in using. And I think for solving that is, on the one hand, for those who actually suffer that they have to do something, to make it easy and intuitive and as little intrusive as possible. And clearly, let's say, where the big benefits are usually those scenarios where all the stakeholders involved have actually something to gain from. Yeah? So, let's say if you take this further, there's a certain information need by managers to assess, to know who has been doing what at a certain time. How to flip that around such that actually employees see the benefits of doing that and doing this in a fair and accurate way. For example, to get benefits in terms of, let's say, that their emails will be switched on and off when they enter work. So actually you check out and then, let's say, something like an automatic reply is being switched on. And such matter of conveniences that you can actually have something to offer for all the parties that are involved by such a change.